Hello and welcome. You're listening to Speaking of Urology, the official podcast for Urology Times. As always, our commitment is to deliver urologists and allied health professionals timely and informative insights from leaders in the specialty. Our exclusive interviews bring expert analysis, practice advice, and policy perspectives to help our listeners practice more efficiently. I'm your host and assistant editor, Hannah Clark. In this episode, we revisit the Urology Times Twitter Spaces podcast, where Dr. Adam Wiener and Dr. Ruchika Talwar discuss some of the notable abstracts that were presented at the American Urological Association annual meeting, which was held in Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Wiener is a urologic oncology fellow at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Dr. Talwar is a urologic oncology fellow at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. They began their discussion by highlighting the background and findings of the EMBARK trial.
I first want to talk about EMBARK. So EMBARK, as many of you have probably heard, is a phase 3 clinical trial that defined patients with high-risk biochemical recurrence as having a PSA doubling time of less than 9 months. They had to have a PSA of greater than 2 if post-radiation therapy. And if they did have radical prostatectomy, they also had to have radiation therapy after that. Their PSA had to be less than 1. So these patients with high-risk BCR randomized 1:1:1 to get androgen deprivation therapy with placebo, hormonal therapy with enzalutamide, or monotherapy with enzalutamide. If their PSA at 36 weeks of treatment was less than 0.2, treatment was stopped, and treatment was only restarted if PSA ever rose above 2 if they were post-prostatectomy, or above 5 if they had not had a prostatectomy. The primary endpoint, importantly in this study, was done to a blinded independent review with METS-free survival, and really comparing the enzalutamide and hormonal therapy versus the placebo plus hormonal therapy. Many secondary endpoints were also assessed, including comparisons to the third treatment arm. The patients were a median of 69 years old. Most patients were white, and a third of them had received some prior hormonal therapy. About a quarter of them had a PSA that was very high, greater than 10. Over 1,000 patients were randomized ultimately in this study. Their median follow-up was 5 years. Primary enzalutamide plus hormonal therapy compared to hormonal therapy and placebo alone produced a hazards ratio of 0.42 when comparing metastasis-free survival. So quite a significant difference. The median failure time was not reached in either of those groups. In terms of overall survival, there was also a strong signal of hazard ratio of 0.59. Median failure was also not reached, of course, in that analysis. Comparing now the monotherapy enzalutamide group, which is, of course, a less common treatment option that we've seen in published clinical trials at this point, comparing that to hormonal therapy alone, the METS-free survival was also very significant with a hazards ratio of 0.63. No new safety signals, of course, were produced in this study. None were really expected. And before we kind of go into more of a discussion, I'm just going to go into the second trial, which is PRESTO. PRESTO similarly defined a group of high-risk biochemical recurrence. Slightly different definitions. Similarly, the PSA doubling time had to be less than 9 months. All of these patients did get prior radical prostatectomy, and their PSAs had to be greater than 0.5 at the time of study enrollment, study entry. They could not, of course, have any metastatic disease on the conventional imaging. All of them had to have prior radiation, either in the adjuvant or their salvage setting, unless, of course, they could not be a radiation therapy candidate. These patients were randomized 1:1:1 to get hormonal therapy or hormonal therapy plus apalutamide or hormonal therapy plus apalutamide plus abiraterone and prednisone. These patients were stratified by their PSA doubling time for by 1 year. And I just want to give a shout out at this moment to thank Dr. Scott Egner for sending me some of the slides from the excellent presentation he gave at the conference last weekend. In terms of the primary endpoint, PSA progression-free survival was defined as the nadir plus 2 during treatment, or if following treatment it just had to be greater than 0.2 over the nadir. Secondary endpoints, including progressive free survival in those who had recovered testosterone following treatment, and just time to testosterone recovery, among other secondary endpoints. In total, 500 patients were randomized. The median PSA at the time of randomization was 1.77. PSA doubling time was very short, defined as less than 3 in about a quarter of patients. So some of these are at a very high risk biochemical recurrence. In terms of the main outcomes, median follow-up was just a little over 2 years. Comparing the hormonal therapy versus hormonal therapy and apalutamide, the median progression-free survival defined by PSA recurrence was 21 months in the ADT alone group and 24 months in those that also got apalutamide. Hazard ratio was 0.59 for this group, so still a strong safety signal and did meet the primary endpoint for the study in terms of that outcome. Comparing hormonal therapy to hormonal therapy plus apalutamide and abiraterone plus prednisone, the 21 months progression-free survival compared to 27.6 months in the combination arm with a hazard ratio of 0.53. No major signal differences on when you stratify these patients based on their PSA doubling times. Hazards ratios were about the same when you focused on just the patients who did have a recovery of their testosterone, which they defined above 50. There was really no difference in time to testosterone recovery, important when counseling patients on their time to becoming eugonadal and the symptoms related to that. The average time or the median time was about 4 to 5 months after treatment stopping, no matter what the treatment was. And of course, no new safety signals. Okay, Ruchi, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think you present some really interesting data. But in general, this research really does define a new category of patients with prostate cancer and you know, high-risk biochemical recurrence. So tell me a little bit about what you think of this group.
Yeah, and I think that's the main interesting thing here and why I think it's important that we focus on re-reviewing these data here. And of course, we'll see the final publications in the coming months. But as we can all imagine, a high-risk biochemical recurrent group is probably a group that's going to disappear in terms of its frequency. We certainly use a molecular imaging with either PSMA PET or otherwise, and that can probably find a metastatic disease that conventional imaging could not detect. And so we could probably probably expect this group of patients will decrease. But it was interesting that they were able to get 1,000 patients in EMBARK and 500 in PRESTO. So very impressive. This is reminiscent of the non-metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer group, more recently defined in studies like TITAN. Of course, we expect that group to decrease as well with more PET scanning. And all of this, of course, is relevant in the setting of more treatments for patients with oligometastatic disease and recent data from trials reporting out like EXTEND, which show that metastasis-directed therapy can certainly help these patients avoid the need for hormonal therapy. So all these things are on the front of my mind when thinking about that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's interesting to think about the advent of PET scans and how detecting, you know, historically invisible disease will shift the paradigm moving forward. Just with regards to the two trials, tell me a little bit about how I should be interpreting this. How do you compare PRESTO to EMBARK?
Right. So I think the main difference here is of course, the primary outcome. We're very impressive in EMBARK, recruiting over 1,000 patients, 5-year median follow-up with a metastasis-free survival outcome compared to PRESTO, which assessed progression-free survival. Of course, we have recent data in the past couple years on large meta-analyses and many trials showing that the only surrogate outcome we have for patients who have diagnosed or treated with non-metastatic prostate cancer, the only true surrogate outcome that we have for overall survival or prostate cancer survival is metastasis-free survival. So certainly some more credence can be given towards EMBARK in that regard. And then, of course, we're talking about enzalutamide monotherapy. And I'm sure many of us on this call are hearing more questions from patients of, can we just get and the enzalutamide or otherwise monotherapy and avoid the need for the androgen deprivation therapy to mitigate some of the potential side effects. So we'll see more about that as we hear more about the side effect profiles as the study continues to report out.
Yeah. And, you know, on the flip side of that coin, for Presto, you have an arm with combined, androgen synthesis inhibitor, apalutamide. Are we starting to see a trend in combination second-generation therapies?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point here, because we've already seen it in the metastatic setting and in the high-risk localized setting in the two reports from Stampede. I can say two now, because just this week they reported on the metastatic setting that when you combine the enzalutamide with the abiraterone, of course, you know, patients seem to benefit plenty from the abiraterone, the androgen synthesis inhibitor, on top of the hormonal therapy. And there doesn't seem to be any benefit from adding the anti-androgen, the non-steroidal anti-androgen, in either of those settings from Stampede. And that seems to be the case from Presto. So I think that's giving us a little bit more of a glimpse into the, you know, how we can expect going forward that might not be getting an added benefit by combining the two, at least in the hormone sensitive setting. So just another confirmation of that. But okay, I think, you know, we've gotten 15 minutes in. We've talked a lot about prostate cancer. I think we should let's move on to hear about our bladder cancer studies.
Sure. Happy to move to bladder. Thanks for that great recap of the, you know, notable prostate trials, though. I'm excited to hear more and see what emerges next. So in terms of bladder, we will move right along and talk first about the SunRISe-1 initial trial data that was reported. So high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, you know, really tough clinical scenario, especially in situations where after BCG failure, patients prefer bladder-sparing modalities. We obviously have Pembro in select situations with CIS, plus or minus papillary tumors, but often patients who can't undergo cystectomy are frail, and IO is still a challenge in this space as well. So I'll recap quickly what Dr. Donishmand from USC presented, which was, again, initial data from SunRISe-1 in patients with BCG-unresponsive, high-risk, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So this was a study evaluating patients who received TAR-200 in combination with an anti-PD-1 versus TAR-200 or the anti-PD-1 alone. TAR-200, just quick review, it's a novel drug delivery system for the sustained local release of gemcitabine in the bladder. And it relies on an osmotic system for release to avoid the systemic toxicity you'll see from gemcitabine. And this cohort included patients with BCG-unresponsive, high-risk, non-muscle invasive bladder cancer who had CIS plus or minus papillary tumors and did not undergo radical cystectomy. They were randomized in a 2-to-1-to-1 fashion to either cohort 1, which is TAR-200 plus cetralumab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor, cohort 2, which is TAR-200 alone, and cohort 3 is the anti-PD-1 agent alone. The data that was presented at AUA last week was of cohort 2 and cohort 3. So it was the monotherapy arms, either TAR-200 or anti-PD-1. Patients who underwent TAR-200 underwent administration of the drug every 3 weeks for the first 24 weeks, followed by every 12 weeks through week 96. Patients in the anti-PD-1 group received the drug through week 78, and the primary endpoint was overall complete response rate. Other secondary endpoints that the authors assessed were duration of response, overall survival, pharmacokinetics data, quality of life, and safety tolerability. So, like I said, this is just initial data, and you know, the sample size in cohort 2 and 3 were only about 23 to 24 patients. Within the cohort, the majority were male, age was 70 to 72 years, and most of the patients in the TAR-200 arm, which was about 70%, had CIS-only disease. In the anti-PD-1 arm, 65% had CIS-only disease. Median total prior BCG doses was 12, and interestingly, when you looked at the reason for why patients did not undergo cystectomy, the vast majority actually declined and were not ineligible for cystectomy. So I think that's important to keep in mind. But there were really some exciting initial results. 73% of patients in the TAR-200 arm achieved a complete response, which was defined based on the results of cystoscopy, central urine cytology, and mandated biopsies at weeks 24 and 48. Likewise, the complete response rate in anti-PD-1 monotherapy was 38%. So again, I want to preface that this data is still immature, but the reassuring CR rates are pretty exciting. After a median follow-up of 11 months, 15 of the 16 responses are ongoing, and 6 people with a complete response actually had a CR rate lasting beyond 1 year. In the anti-PD-1 arm monotherapy, safety and efficacy profiles were pretty consistent with prior studies, but I'll be very curious to see the combination therapy data from cohort 1. Moving right along, the next trial that I'll be discussing was presenting extended follow-up in patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer from the CheckMate 274 trial. So different, very different patient population in the bladder space. Even with radical surgery incorporated into treatment algorithms, patients who have muscle-invasive urothelial carcinoma are very, very high risk for lethal metastatic recurrence. After the initial results from CheckMate 274, adjuvant Nevo after surgery really has now been incorporated in most cases as standard of care. In this presentation, the authors reviewed extended follow-up data, which, you know, was about a median of 3 years, and specifically spent a lot of time focusing on the muscle-invasive bladder cancer arm, since the initial trial did include upper tract patients. Primary endpoints here are disease-free survival in both the intention to treat arm as well as patients who had greater than 1% PD-L1 expression within the tumor. Non-urothelial tract recurrence-free survival was a secondary endpoint, and it's important to define that specifically since you'll remember the initial trial included upper tract patients. The authors also did review extended data from distant metastasis-free survival. Analysis of the muscle-invasive subgroup is exploratory. Inclusion data for this trial included patients with YPT2 to YPT4A or lymph node positive urothelial carcinoma, and patients could have or could have not undergone neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Both were included in this trial, as well as patients who were either ineligible for or who refused adjuvant cisplatin chemotherapy if they didn't undergo neoadjuvant. The interval from surgery was within 120 days, and patients were randomized in a one-to-one fashion with nivolumab versus placebo for less than 1 year. Another point I want to highlight there, it was a fixed duration of adjuvant treatment. It was not a maintenance treatment that was ongoing. So if you look at the patients included in the trial, baseline characteristics, you know, overall about 80% of the cohort had a bladder primary, and the analysis really did hone in on this cohort. 51% of patients had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, 40% of patients had what was considered high, you know, tumor PD-L1 expression, and 53% of patients in the cohort overall had lymph node positive disease. Median disease-free survival benefit was observed with nivolumab in both the intention to treat and muscle-invasive populations. The disease-free survival was 22 months, a median survival of 22 months versus 11 months in the intention to treat arm. And in the muscle-invasive arm, this was 26 versus 8.5, hazard ratio around 0.7. Regardless of PD-L1 status, there was actually a median disease-free survival benefit in all patients, and even in the muscle-invasive population that did have low PD-L1 expression. And, I think, again, notable that this was a durable response. The non-urothelial tract recurrence-free survival benefit was seen in both the intention to treat as well as the muscle-invasive population. I want to spend a couple minutes here talking about this exploratory endpoint that was presented in this analysis, PFS2. So this was a new endpoint that signified that the time from randomization to disease progression after subsequent next line therapy. And when you listen to the authors talk about this, you know, I think they used a really good example to demonstrate what this means. Essentially, if a patient gets randomized to placebo, then progresses, and then starts immune checkpoint blockade for metastatic disease, and then progresses, that's the end time point they used here. And so when you looked at this endpoint, this exploratory PFS2, also you saw a durable response in the nivolumab arm. So all of these endpoints demonstrate a durable advantage with 1 year of adjuvant nivolumab in patients who have muscle invasive urothelial carcinoma who are at high risk for recurrence. So that's a recap of the two major bladder studies. You know, again, two very different disease spaces, high risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, as well as muscle invasive disease in patients who are at high risk for recurrence. But, you know, I do think this data is really important, and it's going to help us improve survival in both these situations.
Wow, Ruchi, really great presentation. I think you really summarized those studies really well and really got to some of the most important points. Why don't we first debrief a bit on Sunrise? You know, I think these data are really exciting. I think, you know, there are limited options for these patients. IV Pembro, others, intravesical therapies that are reporting out. But I just feel at this point, it's still such a low sample size in each cohort. It makes things tough to interpret, at least at this point. What are your thoughts on that?
I could not agree more. You know, I think it's really tough. You haven't even reached that, you know, halfway of the target sample size here. But I think that the CR rates are impressive. I mean, looking at the TAR 200 monotherapy arm, nearly 73% of patients had an overall CR. And you know, I think, again, I'm a little less excited about the anti-PD-1 data, 38.1%. Great. That's definitely consistent with prior trials in this space. And, you know, I understand I can't really compare these head to head, but I think that TAR 200 data excites me. You know, again, I'm one of those people who's like, what do we do for these patients? Tough situation. It's really hard to doom everyone to cystectomy. You know, and I'll be interested to see longer follow-up data once the trial actually accrues target numbers. And again, we didn't really talk about, you know, quality of life data. So let's see what that shows.
Yeah. And on that topic, I mean, what we're avoiding cystectomy or trying to avoid cystectomy because of, you know, the known adverse effects of treatment with radical surgery. Do these studies talk, does that study, there's a presentation going at all about some of the safety of the new medication?
Yeah, definitely. They reviewed adverse effects and safety data. You know, in the TAR 200 arm, there was about 91% of patients had any grade adverse event, but the majority of them were obviously low grade. The things that we saw most often were urinary symptoms like urgency, dysuria, non-infectious cystitis, and urinary tract infection. But there was no obviously systemic side effects, which, you know, is reassuring about the drug delivery system. And in the systemic therapy, we did have about 20% of patients having pruritus, diarrhea. And, you know, there's no surprise there. I think that really is the challenge with immunotherapy, particularly when, you know, discussing it in the context of patients who are managed generally by urologists. You know, this is not a non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. Historically, is not a disease space where we refer to our medical oncology colleagues for systemic therapy. So, you know, I'll be interested to see longer follow-up data in the anti-PD-1 arm because I know that's a real challenge for Pembro right now. Keeping those patients in a urology practice and managing the side effects, it's tough.
Absolutely. I definitely have to agree. The use of IV pembrolizumab for patients in this space is certainly must be limited. I know some of the frequency of that modality was discussed at AUA, and it certainly is limited. So we were talking about non-muscle invasive. Let's talk about muscle invasive. I think it's great that we had an update from the CheckMate trial. I do want to get your opinion on the fact that this is 1 whole year of adjuvant treatment after a patient had already undergone radical surgery. What are your thoughts on the duration of that treatment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I will say I had to do a little deep dive to understand, you know, why the 1 year duration was chosen. Turns out it was sort of random. I shouldn't say random, but it was based on the use of IO in other solid tumors, right? So it's really hard to know if a shorter duration would work. I think obviously we our chemotherapy durations are a lot shorter. So this may be something to explore in the future. I am reassured to see that we have a benefit with a limited duration of adjuvant treatment, though, as opposed to needing maintenance therapy, because this is tough on patients too, you know, especially in the setting of a recent surgery. And you'll note that, again, time from radical cystectomy was generally within 120 days. So not all patients are quite ready. And it's nice to see that it's not something that has to be ongoing. I think, you know, we're about at the 15-minute mark again. I'll make one last comment. I think everyone should stay tuned for that extended overall survival data for this CheckMate trial. I think that's where the money's going to be, and it'll be the most telling, you know, as in terms of integrating this into practice patterns in the long term. I want to make sure we have enough time later for everyone else to jump in with their questions. So, Adam, what do you think about moving on to the renal studies?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And just so everyone knows, if you want to post comments or questions, that's something you can do in this Twitter live space. Just click the little bubble, thought bubble, speech bubble off to the bottom right of your screen. I do want to go into one of the renal studies that was presented at the AUA. This is the phase 3 ZIRCON study looking at PET imaging for indeterminate renal masses. I want to give a shout out to Brian Shuck, one of the faculty here at UCLA, for sending me his PowerPoint slide deck so I can review some of the information in here. And he presented this data at GU ASCO and then again last weekend at AUA. So exciting things here to review. I don't think I have to remind everyone on this phone call, on this live, that current imaging techniques for indeterminate renal masses are limited. And it can be difficult to distinguish between what's a benign and malignant tumor just on imaging alone. As many as a quarter of small renal masses that are actually resected end up being benign. It just depends on the case series that you're looking at. A biopsy is an option for these men, but we all know that's invasive and can come with some limitations in terms of making an actual diagnosis, which can also vary from treatment center to treatment center. So in this context, we also know that clear cell carcinoma, renal cell carcinoma, is the most common RCC and the most common cause of death due to renal cell carcinoma. So the need here that the trialists tried to attack was a need for accurate, non-invasive techniques to risk stratify in the pre-treatment setting for patients with indeterminate renal masses. The important antibody is gerontuximab, which is a long word that describes an antibody that attaches to CA9, which is upregulated in VHL loss or the setting of hypoxia. It's excreted by the hepatobiliary system, so there's no renal excretion, making it an excellent candidate for patients with a possible renal cell carcinoma. Zirconium-89 is the positron emitter that is attached to the gerontuximab antibody, which creates the PET imaging. ZIRCON is the name of the trial, the phase 3 study involving 36 sites in 9 different countries. This is a prospective study with for indeterminate single tumors of less than 7 centimeters seen on conventional imaging with CAT scan or MRI in patients who are scheduled for eventual removal of these tumors either by partial or radical nephrectomy. The tracer is given about 5 days prior to a PET CT scan, and in this trial, the patients had to undergo their extirpative procedure within 90 days of getting the tracer. The primary endpoint here was sensitivity and specificity when compared to a central pathological review, specifically for clear cell renal cell carcinoma. Secondary endpoint importantly included sensitivity and specificity in smaller renal masses defined by T1a or less than 4 centimeters. In total, about 300 patients were ultimately given the tracer. 284 of them were included in the primary data analysis. About 2/3 of these patients ended up having a clear cell renal cell carcinoma as determined by final pathological review. nearly a third of the patients had a papillary RCC, and then very small amount, 8% chromophobe, oncocytoma was in only 9 or 3%. Two-thirds of these patients did have a T1A tumor less than 4 centimeters in size. Okay, getting right to the primary outcome, when averaged over 3 different image readers, the sensitivity and specificity were actually quite excellent for the girentuximab zirconium 89 tracer. The sensitivity is 86%, specificity 87%. A positive predictive value was excellent at 93%. Negative predictive value was 75%. Accuracy, 86%. Okay, well, what about the smaller tumors? So for patients who had an indeterminate renal mass that was less than or equal to 4 centimeters in size, sensitivity still about the same, very excellent at 86%, specificity 90%, a very good positive predictive value, similar 93%, negative predictive value is more modest at 78%, accuracy is 87%. The authors also included a separate exploratory analysis in tumors that were very small, defined as less than 2 centimeters in size. Only about 50 patients met this criteria, and the sensitivity was still excellent at about 84%, specificity in the similar range, 92 to 100%, depending on the reader. Positive predictive value is still very excellent, between 96 and 100%. Negative predictive value, a bit more modest, 75 to 77%. Notably, of the 11 patients who did have a PET positive image, those who were not clear cell RCC on their final histopathology review, still 9 of these 11 patients had a papillary RCC, and 1 patient had a sarcoma, and then 1 patient had a benign renal mass oncocytoma. So even in the patients who were PET positive, but were ultimately diagnosed with a non-clear cell renal cell carcinoma, most of those patients still had a malignancy that probably warranted some extirpative procedure. There were no major unexpected safety issues. All the major adverse effects were related to the surgery itself. So in conclusion, I think this is a very, very exciting new imaging modality. We can certainly conclude that for indeterminate small renal masses, the girentuximab zircon tracer was very sensitive and very specific, and went above and beyond in terms of meeting primary outcomes defined by the researchers here, and certainly opens up the door for this new PET tracer.
Thanks, Adam. Great overview. I agree. Interesting data. Now, just tell me a little bit about, you know, what do you see as the role moving forward, and how do you think this is going to be incorporated, you know, into routine practice?
Yeah, I think that's ultimately, you know, what we need to talk about. This is a great setup for multiple different avenues in which this tracer can be utilized. I think first and foremost, when we think about performing nephron sparing surgery, you know, ultimately the next higher bar is just reducing surgery, any surgery performed on benign tumors. And it, although the negative predictive value was the most modest of each of these outcomes, I think that in certain settings, we can certainly see that this can and help us in our endeavors. And it just depends on how they design their trials going forward. I think additionally, there certainly has to be a space for this tracer or similar ones for certainly staging these patients with a newly diagnosed RCC, perhaps in with more advanced or larger tumors. Currently, as you know, we're using contrast-based imaging, coaxial-based imaging, and then, of course, following these patients who are at high risk for recurrence, there certainly must be a role for patients with clear cell RCC histopathology and following them going forward. And I'm told by Dr. Shuck that this is ongoing work in progress.
Yeah. I mean, I think in that space, this makes a lot of sense. And, you know, we'll just remind everyone that biopsy is not without risk either. Patients who have significant cardiac comorbidities or on blood thinners, you know, who may require a bridge, et cetera. I think I could definitely see this being useful in that space as well. Looking at our chat, we have some questions, which is awesome. Dr. Bukovina has a question for you, Adam. Do you think considering the negative predictive value in zircon leaves us in the same conundrum as to what to do with these scan negative lesions? And most will continue to follow.
Yeah, excellent question. Let's see here. So do you think that leaves us in this is what to do? Well, I think that this is an excellent question. I think when are we using biopsies currently? These are certain patients, perhaps older, some for some reason considering or preferencing surveillance, and perhaps avoiding biopsies in some of these patients may also be preferential. As you all know, we're currently basing a lot of our surveillance strategies off of tumor velocity, tumor measurements and metrics and velocity and changes in those circumstances. And of course, that bases a lot, that lays the foundation for a lot of our basis for surveillance strategies. I think if someone has an indeterminate small renal mass and you're considering surveillance, this is just one other way to kind of add reassurance that perhaps surveillance is something that makes the most sense for them. If there continues to be concern, of course, biopsy is still available. But these are exactly the sort of questions that I think I'm excited to see answered with ongoing work on this tracer.
And what do you think about the zircon findings as they relate to cystic renal masses? Another great question by Dr. Bukovina.
Oh, geez. Great question. And actually, if you had been sitting in Dr. Shuck's presentation, he did talk about some of the uptake in a complex patient that he saw or that they had imaging of in terms of a complex cyst. And in that circumstance, they had a young patient. They had a 3-centimeter tumor that appeared to have a complex cyst, but not a clearly definable solid component. And the imaging that he presented was very clear-cut positive on the girentuximab zirconium PET tracer. And, you know, ultimately this patient did end up going a partial nephrectomy. And ultimately the final pathology was clear cell renal cell carcinoma. So just, it is an isolated circumstance. I think it was very compelling imaging if you were able to sit in on his presentation. And thank you, Dr. Bukovina, for bringing that up, because I think that we encounter these situations quite commonly, and in particular in certain patients trying to avoid surgery if it's unnecessary. But for that patient, it ended up being the straw that broke the camel's back, led to his procedure, and that ultimately it was the right thing to do.
Thanks, Adam. Now, I'll say I'm not off the hook either. So we'll pivot back to bladder, where Dr. Bukovina asked a great question about the SUNRISE trial. I'll read it to the audience. As you know, TAR has been extensively recruiting patients across many disease states in bladder cancer, including muscle-invasive bladder cancer. I'm curious about your thoughts in BCG-naive patients, considering promising results in BCG-refractory disease and how this will compete with BRIDGE. Excellent, excellent question. So first of all, I think more is better in this space. Right now, especially in the BCG-naive population, we are so limited in our options when we have ongoing BCG shortages or lack of access to BCG in many places. So I think, you know, I would look at this not necessarily as in direct competition with BRIDGE. I think that BRIDGE data is going to be very important, but there's going to be certain barriers to administration for intravesical docetaxel and gemcitabine. For example, if you're not in a cancer center or academic institution, you know, you need a compound, you need a specialty pharmacy to mix the drug, to provide the drug. And it's given sequentially, so you have patients there for a longer period of time. And if you have a modality that perhaps does not require some of the pharmacy considerations, I think, you know, it may expand access in practices that necessarily, you know, have barriers to administration from that regard. The other thing I think is going to be really important to keep in mind is cost, because obviously we want to make sure that these treatments are accessible for all populations. So we'll see. I'm hoping that if we have promising, you know, results in the BCG refractory space with the CR rate in the 70s, you know, I'm optimistic that perhaps there'll be some utility in BCG naive disease as well.
Absolutely. Completely agree. I think that's it's a small sample size at this point, but it does deserving of the late breaking abstract sessions just because of the need that I think we're getting at in this patient cohort. And again, I want to thank everyone for listening in, and I want to thank Urology Times for inviting me and Ruchi to do this live event to go over some of the late breaking sessions that were presented at the AUA. We're all pretty busy and can't make it to every single session, despite some of them being very important and potentially a practice session.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks to everyone for joining us. Thanks to Urology Times for hosting, and thanks to Hannah for making it happen.
You just heard an exclusive interview with Dr. Wiener and Dr. Talwar on some of the notable presentations from AUA. Be sure to subscribe to Speaking of Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest in urology news, practice management advice, and health policy updates by visiting urologytimes.com or by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Urology Times. Thank you for listening.